From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made last Friday when Rochester mayoral candidate Malik Evans unveiled his plan to reduce illegal guns in Rochester. During a news conference, Evans called the increase in shootings in the city a, quote, state of emergency. According to the RPD open data portal this morning, there have been 103 shooting incidents this year with 124 victims. Evans' plan would include hiring a gun czar and a push for changes in state and federal laws that would reduce the flow of illegal guns. He said prosperity in Rochester is tied to getting a hold on gun violence, which he called a social and economic issue. Malik Evans' news conference was scheduled prior to some of the events of last week when state police raided the home of his opponent, Mayor Lovely Warren. Her husband, Timothy Granison, was arrested on gun and drug charges. He has pleaded not guilty. This hour, we will be joined by Malik Evans, who is going to discuss his proposals to address illegal guns, among a number of other issues. We invited Mayor Lovely Warren to join the conversation with us either this hour, with us at the same time that Malik Evans is on, or separately. We did not hear back from City Hall or from her campaign, but that is an open invitation, of course. Now, the mayor spoke with City Magazine reporter Gino Finelli on Friday. And, you know, City News had this interview that was scheduled with the mayor right before the state police raid. And interestingly, the mayor then did follow through and have that conversation with City News and Gino Finelli. And we've asked Gino to come back and talk to us about that. Welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Much to the mayor's credit that she followed through on Friday and did that interview almost, what, 24 hours? I mean, the last week's sort of a blur to me now. What days, what happened? Your interview with her actually happened on Friday, right?
On Friday, yeah. About little less than 2 days after the raid on her house.
Okay. And it was, again, listeners, if you missed it, Gino and City News had an interview with the mayor scheduled at 5 o'clock, 5:15 on Wednesday, right when all of this stuff was going down.
Mm-hmm.
So they canceled that, but they followed through. You talked to the mayor on Friday at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And let me just start by asking, you know, how you focused that conversation. Was it only about the events of the week, or did you have a chance to include some other things as well?
So when we originally had planned the interview, we had a series of questions that we wanted to ask about, you know, past controversies throughout her time in office, the Daniel Prude incident, the Police Accountability Board. A lot of the things that are on the top of the mind of a lot of people in Rochester, but obviously that changed pretty radically over the course of 48 hours. So we talked quite a bit about the events of the past 2 days, the arrest of her husband, the arraignment, how she found out what was happening, some of the rumors that have been floating around about her. And I tried to explore as much as I possibly could about what kind of questions were pressing on a lot of people in Rochester's minds over, you know, the events of the past 2 days.
Now, when it comes to the questions of the last week, let's focus a little bit there. The raid happened at the mayor's house. The mayor, in her statement that she did before your interview with her, when she made a televised and public statement without taking questions, she said, essentially, look, at that point, who lived in that house that the police raided? Because that is her listed address, and she owns the home. You asked her if she lived there.
I did, yes.
And she said?
She said, yes, she does. That is her home. And she doesn't know why anyone would say any differently. If you go on social media, there's lots of rumors about her living in Fairport, Parrington, Penfield, all kinds of different places, all completely unsubstantiated. None really have much evidence. Both Mayor Warren and the District Attorney Sandra Dorley have said that Dorley had said that she believes that to be her home, and Mayor Warren said that is my home. So she did answer that question and confirmed that she does live on Woodman Park.
Okay. And that's relevant for a number of reasons. Number one, you've got to be a city resident to run for mayor. We're bringing this up because the mayor said she's separated from her husband.
Mm-hmm.
And the raid was focused on Timothy Granison, as far as we know, not the mayor herself. So if she's separated from her husband, that's why I think those questions were pertinent. They weren't meant to be sort of be provocative in any way. I think it was important to understand who lives there and what do we know about this. Now, what else were you able to talk with her about when it comes to those incidents, what we saw with the police last week?
Well, as I mentioned, when I was on Thursday, one of the main questions on my mind was, what did you know and when? And that was one of the questions that we did go through. And Warren claims that she found out about the raid that was happening on her home through an email from the New York Times asking her about it. That was something that was handed to, I believe, her chief of staff, it was asking this question that she said she didn't know anything about at the time, and that's how she found out her house was being raided. She also said, when asked about, you know, what she knew about this, that she's not going to be defined by somebody's actions that I had a legal separation from. That was the quote she had about her response to the charges against her husband.
I think that's largely fair. I mean, I think this is a case where if she's legally separated from Timothy Granison, you know, I understand the idea that, hey, the charges are against him, not me. I get that. The part that I think is fair to at least continue to probe on is, you know, they have a young daughter. I don't know how old their daughter is, but they've got a young daughter that they are apparently co-parenting. And so if there are illegal guns in her house, why are they there? Did she know they were there? Because illegal guns are a big problem in Rochester, right? I mean, I think those questions are inbounds, do you think?
They are. They absolutely are. And my understanding from our conversation is she just didn't know anything about it. And that seems to be the story that she's standing by. And that seems to be the scenario that she believes that she's in.
Do you feel like you understand the facts of that, of her side of the things, pretty well after that conversation? Or are there still unanswered questions?
I don't think I understand it very well at all. I think I asked these questions and I got answers and I got her side of things, but she did decline to answer some questions or point to the press statement she had given Thursday. And it's just, I don't believe I've gotten full clarity about everything, but I think there's some insight that was gotten from having that interview.
Yeah. And okay. So let me make a couple things clear for listeners here. You did this interview on Friday. Where are people going to be able to find your coverage of this based on the interview? What's the plans for City News?
So this was planned as, and still is, a story for our June 1st issue on the mayoral race. But this story should be online sometime this week. So keep an eye out for it. We'll be sharing it out. And it's a very comprehensive coverage of everything that's happened throughout the past year and leading up to this mayor's race. So check RochesterCityNewspaper.com and keep an eye out for it.
So when you say that during the interview, the parts that you didn't feel like you got answers on, she referred to either her statement or sort of said, look, I already talked to other people about this. The things that came up to me was she sort of opaquely referred to some kind of evidence that fell through. I wasn't sure what she was talking about there. So is that kind of what you were trying to press on? Like, you're trying to get an explanation for some of the things she said in her statement?
Yeah, the one, that particular piece was about a piece of evidence that had disappeared during her campaign finance case. And she had mentioned it during her statement that there was a piece of evidence that was being held that had, it was a recording that had disappeared. And I asked her, can you clarify a little bit what you meant by that? And she essentially pointed me, said there was a Channel 13 story that had mentioned this and told me to do my research. And that was pretty much the only answer I got from that.
I mean, I think that's, you know, I mean, I would, in a very good-natured way, I would say to the mayor or anybody who says that to me, I think that's kind of baloney. You do your research. Clearly, when she made that statement, that was very hard to understand, I think, for the public. And mm-hmm. I think it's incumbent upon an elected official to explain what they mean by these things. Otherwise, why are you mentioning it? That was, I found that very strange.
And it's a pretty, I mean, if that is true, and there was a piece of evidence in her case that had disappeared, I mean, that's a pretty important piece to all of this story. And I wish I had more details about it, and I wish I could have been provided more details, but it didn't happen.
Yeah, and the odd thing here, Gino, is one of the things that Gino and I and Jeremy Mull from City News talked about before we even chatted on the air on this program on Friday, or Thursday, whatever day it was that we don't want to engage in too much speculation. There's already enough speculation out there.
Absolutely.
Our goal is to work journalistically to report what we know is factual and to leave speculation for other people. Well, when the mayor makes statements like that and then says, you know, I've said all I'm going to say about that, I don't know what she means, and it sort of encourages strange speculation. I guess the answer is I wish I knew more about what she means there, and it sounds like we're not going to get more.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that in cases like this, it often turns into, it lends itself to conspiratorial thinking mm-hmm. sometimes. And when no one is going to provide clarity on what they mean when they say things like, evidence went missing, this is politically charged, things like that, and you it lets the public run wild with whatever interpretation they want to make about what the scenario is.
You also had a chance to ask her if she could say a little bit more about why she thought what happened with the police last week in her house was politically motivated. Because in the mayor's statement, she did two things that, in a sense, you could argue are kind of contradictory. She said she's not going to defend her husband on this. She's not going to defend Tim Granison. She's not going to comment on the charges against him, but she didn't come out and say this is bogus. She said, I'm not going to defend him on this. So if she's not going to defend him, why is she saying the charges are political? I guess maybe the timing, perhaps? I don't know. Did she say more to you about why she thinks it's a political sort of a hit job when she's also not defending Tim from the charges?
Not really. She pointed mostly to the statement that she had given on her thoughts on that.
Uh-huh. Okay. I guess the question I would have then is, when is it appropriate to make an arrest or to pursue an investigation? Is it a month from an election? Is it too close? A week is too close? Is a year too close? When is too close? I mean, I guess we don't have an indication of that.
No time is a good time.
Well, not for politicians.
Yeah, no time's a good time. And one of the main things she had brought up at the press statement she gave in, again, their conversation was that the next court date is scheduled the day before the primaries. But the reality is the attorney for Granison actually had decided that date. So it's hard to say. There's always a possibility that things are politically motivated, but it's an easy explanation when there's a problem that this is a political attack.
Okay. Did you get a chance to talk to her about what she does think is going to motivate voters here? Because, you know, I know that your coverage has focused on, for much of the last year, on the Daniel Prude case, on her sort of relationship to the facts in that case, what the city learned, what voters and residents learned, and where we are with that. She has defended her own actions. She has been very critical of former police chief Singletary. Has she given you a sense for what she thinks is driving the motivation of voters, and whether it's on her own record or what people are going to be voting on?
Absolutely, her whole record. That is her main focus, and the main thing she tried to focus on it throughout much of the interview is the Department of Neighborhood and Business Development and some of the initiatives she's had there. Finishing of the Rock City Skate Park was another proud accomplishment. And she did mention many times that even though all the problems that we've had with police over the past year and, well, before then, too, that's only one department of the city, and that we've done all this work in all these other areas to help small businesses, help entrepreneurs, help economic activity spur. So she is very much running on a campaign of look at my record and, make your decision based on that rather than whatever is going on in her life, her personal or political life.
Okay. And I suspect she feels like the focus of at least the last year has been too much on these various sort of scandals or other issues and not on what she perceives to be her effective record.
Yeah, that would be accurate.
Okay. How long did you have in this interview?
About 25 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good amount of time one-on-one.
Yes.
And I certainly give her credit for that, and I'm really glad to hear she did that. Do you feel that there are still things that if you get another chance to talk to her that is top of mind for you that you didn't either get to or you don't fully have a good explanation?
Well, I'd like to go a little bit deeper into her relationship with Granison. They're separated, but co-parenting. They live together, as far as my understanding is. Is there plans for a divorce? How does this situation work where you can live with a person and raise a kid together in the same house and not know about anything that was happening behind the scenes? And, it's not my place to dig into a person's personal life, but it does raise questions when that person is a very high-ranking political figure.
Okay, so to be clear on this, you're not saying it's our right to know every piece of the arrangement they have personally. You think the public does have a right to ask some questions. If she's going to be leading efforts to reduce illegal guns, if there are illegal guns in her house where her daughter is, you think the public has a right to ask those
Absolutely,
questions?
Yes.
Okay. And you think we've got a right to at least ask how much knowledge she had or not of whatever was happening with Tim?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And that does not sound like something she was willing to touch very directly.
Not really, no. I mean, to my understanding from what she said to me is just, I didn't know anything. I found out about this through the New York Times email.
Okay. And on the subject of Malik Evans, are you going to have a chance? I mean, we're going to talk to him in just a moment on this program, but your own coverage for City, you focused on the mayor here. What is City planning, you know, to lay out in the June issue coming up? Can you give us a sense for what's coming people's way?
Sure. So we sat down with Malik about a week and a half ago and had about an hour and 45-minute conversation right around there. We had a very long interview and went in through a lot of details and went through a lot of tough questions about the future of the city and everything. We've also spoken with a number of political commentators, political science professors who have watched the race, have understood the nuances going on and how the dynamic might have switched since last week. Earlier last week, even, Lovely was seen as a really heavily tilted in her favor that the race was going to go to her. And after conversations Friday, that has changed a bit. So, all these things are together in one pretty encompassing story, and it's I'm really proud of the work that went into it, especially all the crunch time we put in the last couple of days. So keep an eye out for it.
City has been indispensable on this and so many issues. So before I let you go, the last point is, as you say, you know, there's always going to be speculation on, you know, is the campaign going in the favor of one candidate or another? The longer you report on campaigns, the more you find out everybody's got internal polling. And Gino Finelli's internal polling says that Gino is polling very strongly. I just want you to know this.
I like to think so.
Yeah. Even my internal polling, and I don't even like myself, finds that, you know, I'm doing very, very well. So that's one of the reasons you sort of take that with a grain of salt. But I think there is a poll coming from, I don't know if it was Channel 8 or somebody else, coming perhaps today or tomorrow. There's been talk of actual scientific poll. I haven't seen anything scientifically. So everything that we're hearing on where the state of the race is just sort of speculation, right?
Pure, unfiltered speculation. That is what it is.
You go back 8 years, and there was a Siena poll that showed Tom Richards with a solid lead over Lovely Warren. And I just don't think that you can put any other narrative out from 8 years ago other than she outworked everybody. She outworked her opponent. She outworked expectations. They got the vote out, and she was the president of city council. But boy, that was a remarkable success from the mayor's perspective. And to her credit, she outworked everybody. She won a big victory 8 years ago. And we all looked at the polls going, why did we even do this? Why did we even poll this? It's very hard to poll primaries because not a whole lot of people vote, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And it's important to remember, no matter what's going on, though, these two people that are running are two very skilled and entrenched political figures in Rochester. Lovely Warren is a very skilled campaigner. She's proved that time and time again. Malik Evans has served for a long time on both the Board of Education and then on City Council. These are two people that know what they're doing when it comes to running a race in Rochester, and it makes it a lot more interesting where all these other pieces pop up and you have two people that are running pretty solid campaigns and know what they're doing. It's impossible just to call it based on intuition.
Yeah. And it's just so different this time around. Running for a third term, she's entrenched as an incumbent. She has a lot of those benefits. She knows people well. And so I'll close with Gino Finelli with this. This is a city. I love this city. But this is a city that, to the extent that we've been in national headlines in the last year plus, it has not been for the right reasons. It's not been for the things that you would hope would put us in the national headlines. How does the mayor feel about that? Did you have a chance to ask her about that?
I did. And again, I point to what I said she said earlier, that you know, the police department is just one part of a lot of different departments of the city. And she points to accomplishments more than the bad things that have happened. And I think at the core of it all is we've developed a real distrust of City Hall in this city in the past year. And that's probably going to sway voters a bit, but she sees that her record speaks for itself, and these bad things do not outweigh the good things that have happened. So that's her position.
Yeah, and to Gino's point, you can speculate all you want on how people are going to vote. She has personal relationships with so many people in the city. Look at the video that the mayor released this weekend of her singing outside a church service and then praying and crying in the street with people, and it was like a prayer circle, and it was very powerful. And the mayor is going to rely on those relationships, which have been forged over years. So no way to know. June 22nd is the primary. June 1st is the next issue of City News.
Yes, sir.
And you know, listeners, you know where to find it. It's an amazing resource, and it is phenomenal journalism. Gino Finelli is a staff writer for City Magazine. Thank you for the work the City News is doing on this great stuff.
Thank you so much.
All right. Want to remind you, as we go to our only break here, we'll talk to Malik Evans in just a moment here. We, of course, invited Mayor Warren, and we will continue to do that. It is an open invitation, and we respect and hope the mayor and hope that eventually we'll be able to have that conversation. But in lieu of that, that's why we welcomed in Gino. And let's take that only break, and we'll talk to Malik Evans. Coming up in our second hour, we're joined by Dr. Lucy McBride, who has written for The Atlantic Monthly, among other publications recently. She writes about the fear of returning to normal and the anxiety that some parents have about their kids who are too young to be vaccinated when a lot of the adults around them are vaccinated. What do we do this summer? Dr. McBride says we should not be masking our kids outside. And she says summer camp should reconsider some of the rules. We'll talk about all of that and more next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Malik Evans is a member of Rochester City Council and is running for mayor, and put out a plan, well, really sort of fleshed out more detail for a plan to deal in many respects with illegal guns in the city. It's a chance to talk to him about that platform, his specific ideas, and some of the connected issues that sort of all run together here. Malik Evans, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Evan. And I'm glad you said we fleshed out, because we did put out a plan earlier, our compact with the community, and this is just more detail of that plan.
Yeah. And so listeners, you know, we always direct listeners to the websites of all candidates. So we'll put links to the mayors, we'll put links to Malik Evans, and you will find in the compact section specific ideas on a number of things here. And last week had a chance to hear from the Evans campaign about what might be done with illegal guns. To be clear, Malik, all of that was planned before we saw, for example, the state police raiding the mayor's home. Is that correct?
Absolutely. My campaign is pretty disciplined and planned out. We plan things weeks in advance in terms of topics that we're going to talk about every week, including this week. So we keep a pretty detailed campaign calendar of things that we're going to do. And obviously, because of the level of gun violence that we've seen in this community, the gun plan has been laid out for quite some time.
Now, let's walk through some specifics here. You have a thought that it would be beneficial for City Hall in a Malik Evans administration to hire a gun czar who would be focused on this issue. What would be the advantage of a gun czar position in a city where we've recorded, what, around 100 shootings, 120 shooting, actually 103 shootings now, and 124 shooting victims for the year, officially, as of this morning? 15 people have died. What would a gun czar be able to do?
I mean, just think of those numbers that you just laid out. I mean, it's unbelievable. A gun czar would be able to, would be responsible for bringing all the forces together to combat this gun violence that we're seeing, and literally violence in general, but guns in particular, because the vast majority of the violent incidences that we have seen over the last many years, but unfortunately in the first 5 months of this year, were done by firearms, and most of those firearms are illegal. We know that many of them have come from what we call the gun pipeline states. So a gun czar would be able to hopefully coordinate our local, state, federal, our community-based organizations, everyone around a common plan to reduce gun violence. And again, we would look at root causes, and that's what a gun czar would do. That's why this person is just not meant to be a person that is is a former police officer or something like that, but someone who has a deep understanding of also community. So it's a tall order. So this would be a very, very high-level individual and someone that would be able to really tackle this crazy, crazy problem that we have that seems to be out of control, not just here, but across the country.
Where do you think is in our community the guns are primarily coming from?
Well, I mean, if you look at a previous report, and I hope that one day the AG might update this report, The report in terms of New York State, this report that was done by Schneiderman, and that probably was about 4 or 5 years ago, said that 76% of the guns trafficked into New York came through what they call the iron pipeline, which consisted of states that had, looser gun laws, Pennsylvania, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, and to some extent in Ohio, all along that I-95 corridor. I think the three biggest states for New York were at the time Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Georgia. So, it's obviously it's not the only solution to a problem, but we do know that there is a proliferation of guns in this community. And I believe it was last weekend, the weekend before last, where you had an 11 and 13 year old injured by gunfire on a Friday and then a Saturday night. So it's a major challenge, and we know that guns are getting in the hands of people who aren't exactly going down to the county clerk's office and filling out a pistol permit form. Most of these guns are illegal, and they're on our streets.
So, I know you know of so many approaches over the years. I mean, and really good faith, hardworking efforts from people like yourself or the mayor or other members of council, the law enforcement community, activists, so many. And for the most part, we haven't seen success in this way. Why do you think, I have to, again, clarify, Malik, I mean, I think to your credit in my conversations with you, you have not sought to simplify any issue or oversimplify. I know these are complex. Mm-hmm. And you're not sitting here saying, this will be easy, everyone's going to have a job, and there'll be no illegal guns. I mean, I know it's complex. But why do you think, if you are the mayor, things could be different when so many efforts have failed?
Yeah, I mean, I hope that things will be different. But again, I don't have a magic wand. I think that we have to follow the data. And I think oftentimes what happens in a community is we say, if we just do this one thing, things will be better. But that's why I think that what you see in terms of the plans that we're rolling out is that they're a multi-pronged approach. And I think that that's what you have to take in order to solve these complex issues that have bedeviled cities for many years. So you just can't talk about, for example, our youth opportunity agenda that we rolled out as it relates to getting young people jobs 365, 24/7, and then not address the proliferation of guns that come in illegally. So we do both at the same time. So I think that that's one thing that's different here is that we're looking at this from a holistic standpoint, where you have the enforcement piece, which is the trying to stop illegal guns from getting here, which is a major challenge, and trying to work with our state and federal partners to do that, supporting Senate Bill 4116, which requires semi-automatic pistols manufactured or delivered to any licensed dealer in the state to be capable of micro-stamping ammunition. So that's one thing you're doing. But we have to look at root causes, because if we don't look at root causes, we'll never really solve the problem. And I truly believe that if people are working and if they're involved in positive activities and they are so exhausted from doing those things, that they won't have time to pick up a gun. They won't have time to get involved in violence. Or if they are involved, or if they do get involved in an incident that might cause them to have a connection with the criminal justice system, that connection will go through teen court when they're young. They'll get they'll get community service, or they'll have some type of small restitution, and then they'll be able to go on with their way. So root cause problems along with enforcement married together, I think that that's different when you look at my plans.
Yeah, and so it sounds like your argument here, and please certainly correct or expand upon this, but it's essentially sounds to me like the concern is that, for example, struggling schools, for example, gun-based violence, are symptoms in a society that tolerates or has created a lot of poverty without improving upon the lives of people in poverty. We have an anti-poverty initiative going back 6-7 years now. I don't know if you have in your own mind a feeling that that's enough time to say it's working or not. And again, I know these are good faith efforts and people want it to work, but do you think it starts with poverty and so much of what we're seeing is sort of the symptoms of the main problem?
Well, I think poverty is always an issue, right? It's always one of the many factors. That's one. Mental health is also one. Not being trained in mediation and how you handle disputes is another one. So again, I think it's multi-pronged. I think the challenge for us as a community and really as a country is that we sometimes look for just because, I mean, we're human. We look for that one or that one thing that we're like, man, if we can just fix this one thing, this will eradicate it. I think poverty, of course, it is one. I mean, if people don't have money to provide for themselves, they sometimes will do things to get money that might not be safe, legal, or practical in the long term, right? So you want to be able to deal with that issue. And putting money in people's pockets and making sure that people are working and getting skills is a surefire way to make sure that people do well. But the other issue is that, you know, a lot of violence is based upon personal disputes. So how do you get involved with young people on very early on to talk to them about peer mediation and alternatives to violence? I mean, one of the reasons why I am where I am today is because in junior high school, I was trained as a peer mediator. So it was very rare for me to really get into disputes with people because I'm able to deploy those skills to get out of them. So how do we get our young people and even our adults connected with mediation type programs where they can learn how to deal with disputes that way? So it's a multi-pronged approach when you're talking about violence and trying to reduce violence. But guns play a major, major part. And I've been clear to people because, you know, sometimes when you talk about guns, people say, are you talking about taking guns away? No, we're talking about illegal guns that are on the streets, that the Gun Control Act of 1968 was supposed to be able to ameliorate, and it has not. And we've seen what's happened. A young kid said to me the other day, he said, I feel like I'm one of the only few people that don't have a gun. That should alarm us. That should scare us that you have young people saying that they feel as though they are in the minority of people not having a firearm. It's very, very concerning.
To be fair to the mayor, who has chosen not to join us on this program, isn't a lot of what you're saying, though, the kind of thing that she's been saying for years?
I don't know. I can't. You'd have to ask her that. I mean, you don't have her on this program, so I can't speak for the mayor, and I don't pretend to. Evan, I put out my plan. I think that we've seen an increase in gun violence, 60% over last year, and that's really what I am working to try to address. But I think it's a challenge. But we have to do something about it for the long term viability and health of our city.
On Friday, the mayor told City News that she does live in that home with her daughter, that home that was raided by state police, in which there was at least one, perhaps more, illegal guns found. Do you think the mayor has the credibility to handle the issue of illegal guns in this city?
Well, I think the voters will decide that in about a month. The voters will decide that in about a month. And so we'll see what happens there. I mean, obviously, illegal guns are a major problem in this community. They're a major problem in this country. They are responsible for lots of bloodshed. I've seen what illegal guns can do up close and personal. When I had someone murdered outside my house when I was 17 years old, my father had to go testify in front of the grand jury. I know many people have been murdered with guns. I've gone to many funerals for people who have been killed with guns. It's a major problem in our community, and the disproportionate number of people who are affected by them look like me. They are black and brown young men, and it really is a drain on our society because these people who are being killed, Evan, they could be the next astronauts or find a cure for cancer, and we're losing many lives. And the problem is a lot of these folks are young. I mean, if you look at the shooting victims, I think almost 80 of them are under the age of 25 this year. And if you look at the homicide victims, about a dozen of them are almost half a dozen of them are school-age kids, which means that they are still in the education system. So imagine the impact, the trauma that has on young people. 2 weeks ago, you had a young man on the west side, 11 years old, was in his house minding his own business. There was a shootout. He was shot. He probably was there Sunday getting ready for school the next day. So the trauma, the impact that we're seeing here is what needs to be put front and center. My challenge is that I think that people in this community have become so desensitized to it that we kind of just like stop talking about it. I look at the news reports and sometimes I read them out loud to people, and it's almost like, you know, just talking about the weather. There was another shooting and on this street and this would happen. Anyone with information is asked to call 911. It's almost as if becoming numb to it, and that's scary for me. That's scary for me. Mm-hmm. And as mayor, I want to work to try to do something about that.
Last point on this subject. Go ahead, Malik.
Yep. No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say the last point on this subject then would be, I think you're right. People will weigh in a month. What are the issues that matter to them substantively? What are the issues that drive credibility? And you're right. They'll make decisions about you. They'll make decisions about the mayor. The mayor has said to City News, you know, she is not her husband. she should not be held responsible. And it's not fair to try to sort of insinuate that she is responsible for what he is charged with. Do you think that's a fair defense for her to make?
Yeah, look, I don't get involved in people's personal relationships. I just don't. I never have. I can't tell you what's going on in the mayor's house. I'm concerned about what's going on in the people's house, which is City Hall. I think that, I look at things that went on that go on at City Hall, the Daniel Prude situation where people weren't truthful about a man dying in police custody and the community finding out about it 9 months later. Those are the things that I'm most concerned about. But I learned a long time ago from my father. He had a great saying. He said, Malik, you can't worry about what's going on in other people's house. Let's worry about what's going on in your house. And the house that I'm most concerned about what's going on right now is the people's house, which is City Hall. And that's what I'm going to speak towards. What happens between the husband and the wife and those types of things, that will play itself out. But I think direct questions related to the mayor and her relationship with her husband are best reserved for her.
Okay. Michael emails to ask, can you ask the candidate, what happened to Project Exile? Is that still going on, Malik Evans?
Oh, yeah, I believe it is. Project Exile, if you remember the billboards, you plus illegal gun equals prison. Project Exile is pretty much good question. It is still alive. It is still alive and well. But you have to understand, in order for someone to get Project Exile, you have to catch them with an illegal gun, and that hasn't been happening as of late. Yes, as of late, I mean, gun people have been shot and all those things, but a lot of these things have not been solved. A lot of these cases have not been solved.
I want to ask you about something that happened following a mass shooting in Rochester last year, and what I'm about to ask you is not just reserved for you or your opponent in this race. It's really for all sort of local power brokers, especially in the Democratic Party, because I've been struck by how little I've heard, and maybe I've just missed it. It's the story of what happened with Lakiya Sinclair. She was 19 years old when a mass shooting happened at her house last September. She went to her county legislator, Ernest Flagler Mitchell, for support and guidance. And over time, Flagler Mitchell began making personal comments on her Facebook page about her attractiveness. And then he sent her a picture of genitalia. She was shocked. She thought he was interested in helping her deal with the trauma in her life. And instead, she said she was inflicted with more trauma. Now, Flagler Mitchell is a longtime ally of the late David Gantt. He's very close with the mayor. The mayor has not, to my knowledge, offered any support to Lakiya Sinclair. She has not joined the calls for Flagler's resignation. She has not criticized him at all. Flagler has said he sent the explicit photo by accident. It was intended for his wife, even though the rest of that message thread makes his explanation extremely unlikely. Have you said anything about this case? And if not, why have you not talked about that?
No, what I said was it belongs with the Ethics Committee where it is, and I understand that it's being investigated by the Ethics Committee, and we'll wait to see what comes from there.
Are you concerned about the impact on this 19-year-old woman?
Exactly. Of course I am. I'm always concerned about the impact, and I think it's important that we support folks in the community with these types of situations when they happen, and I'm glad that the Ethics Committee is taking a look at it.
All right. On the mayor's budget, she recently rolled out her own budget, which city council will vote on. She has expanded funding. She'd like to see expanded funding, significantly increasing the size of the PIC teams, the person in crisis teams, which are designed to allow mental health specialists to handle some interactions that police have traditionally handled. Do you support that?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely essential that we expand funding for mental health. The other thing that we have to do is to work to see how we are going to coordinate with the county and the FACET team. I think that you need to have some coordination there. Often what happens is you hear that there's a case and someone's not available. So we need to make sure that whatever we do, that there is adequate coverage for people to be able to have a mental health professional when it is required. I think it is also very important that 911 operators are trained, detailed, and able to detail a situation in which a mental health case is coming. And if the city's PIC team is not available, what does that interplay look like with the county? I believe that a lot of what we talk about in government, execution is absolutely critical to it. Sometimes it's not the dollars. So while we set aside money for PIC, yes, that's necessary. And the county has FACET. Yes, that is also necessary. What it really comes down to is our execution and coordination between the two entities to ensure that they are able to offer the coverage for mental health cases. I tell the story regularly of my father, who worked in mental health for many years, and he was able to de-escalate so many situations that could have gone sideways. Police officers aren't trained to be mental health professionals. I think that some of them should get that training, but we need to make sure that we use mental health professionals for situations that can be de-escalated and won't result in violence. There is a data out there that shows that many people who have mental health challenges, when they come into contact with police, sometimes that situation can be escalated, where if we use the mental health professional at that time, it could have been de-escalated. So, yes, we need to expand money, funding, and provide money for the PIC team, but we also have to work to see what the interplay with the county will be. Because as I remind people, the mental health department is with the county. So there could be some great interplay and some great collaboration there as well.
Yeah. And so when we think about the difference in what police are asked to do, sort of across the range of the kinds of calls they get. Yes, we talk about gun violence. We talk about the kinds of high profile cases that the public hears about. But we also know that the vast majority of police calls do not involve that. And some of the work is really hard. City News rode along with the PIC team. And, you know, they're asked to be problem solvers in so many ways, some of which they've got training for, some of which they, you know, sort of have minimal training, if anything, for. And I don't know how you feel about this, Malik. My sense is that maybe police would welcome handling fewer calls eventually and seeing more specialists in different ways if that worked out that way. Is it your sense that police will oppose anything that reduces the number of officers in the force? Do you want to see a reduction in the number of officers in the force? And do you think you can facilitate sort of a productive path forward there if you're the mayor?
Yeah, exactly. But first of all, Evan, let me back up. And again,
sure,
I think
sure.
People look at things in such a simplistic way. I talk to a lot of police professionals around the country, one of which, Cedric Alexander, who I talk to regularly about this, who is a trained psychologist, but also a former police chief. Look, we have to look at the way we want policing to be. So we have to take a step back. Okay, and one of the first things I would do as mayor is take a step back and stand at the top of the steps of City Hall and say, okay, what do we want policing to look like? And that would include conversations with community-based organizations, activists, the police, and everyone else, and anyone else that wants to be involved to say, what do we want policing to look like? Do we want police officers to show up and be the first people on mental health calls? Should they have to do things that aren't related to policing that sometimes can be non-lethal? And we have to do that because we don't need police reform. We need culture change, right? And once you get culture change, then the reform can follow. When you try to do reform without culture change, it doesn't work. So many police departments have had reform, L.A., Newark, and they still have the exact same challenges, right? So that's the first step. The first step is you look at what does policing look like? How do you move police officers from being seen as warriors to guardians? And that doesn't mean a guardian doesn't mean that you're weak, right? A guardian means that you're there to protect and serve, right? And that's what we need to start having the conversation about. And what that means is making sure that when you talk about mental health, that there are mental health professionals that are there. That when you talk about the interaction with police officers, that they're okay with also referring people to community-based organizations that could help a homeless person that might need to go over to you name the organization that might be able to help them with homelessness. And that's a new way of thinking. It's a new way that's going to make us more safe. And it's a new way that's going to connect the police to the community, because you're able to solve more crimes when you have trust within the community. And part of that starts with having that conversation on saying, OK, here's what policing is going to look like. The second thing it starts with is this concept of trust and transparency, what I talk about. And I just don't mean trust and transparency with police. I mean it across the board. So, for example, if something happens and there's a police incident, immediately you have the police and the mayor put out the body cam footage, put out all the information that is known, and then have a conversation with the relevant community partners. Then that's going to allow a conversation with the larger community that will then start to build that trust that we need as we look at transforming what policing really is. So this is a complex issue. It's not something that you can talk about in a soundbite. It's not something that you can talk about even on your radio program for the time that we have. It's something that's going to involve a seat at the table for many different people in order to transform the way we think about policing. But it has to start with culture change. Culture change would then lead to reform, and then that will lead to less violence, less need for police at different things. But it's not going to be overnight, and it's going to take time, and it's going to take lots of people who are interested in solving the challenges that we have in our community working together to transform the way we think about policing in this community.
Is one of those seats at the table reserved for the Locust Club, and what is your relationship with them?
You have to have seats at the table for everyone, including the Locust Club. You have to talk to because that's the union that the police belong to. You have to have everyone in the room, people who hate each other or don't like each other. We're all going to have to get in the room to figure out how we're going to go forward to change these things. Obviously, there will be some non-negotiables. Like, for example, we're not pepper spraying or handcuffing little kids, right? So for me, some of those things aren't going to happen in the Evans administration. I'm going to make that clear. Mm-hmm. But in terms of larger conversations, you have to do that. That's what building bridges are all about. And that's how you start to get this transformational change in our community.
What about the Police Accountability Board, which requested a $5 million budget? The mayor's budget includes that full $5 million figure. Do you support that?
Well, right now I do. I think we need to go through the budget. We're going through the budget process. I always remind people sometimes we have two branches of government. I'm sure you know this, and as chair of the Finance Committee, I like to be able to do my due diligence with all of the department's budgets. So we'll go through that. But I like to point out that I supported the Police Accountability Board from the beginning, if folks don't know that. Started back in 2017 before I took my seat on City Council. I've been supportive of the Police Accountability Board and their plan that was initially laid out to work through the community. I think that they also have a role to play as we look at transforming public safety in our community. And I'm excited to see what the next steps will be for them. Obviously, they're new and they're going through growing pains just like everyone else. But they were voted in by 73% of the community back in 2019.
I'm going to take a phone call from Jane in Rochester. Hi, Jane. Go ahead.
Hi. Evan and Malik, I think important constituents right now related to the primary are those, especially people of color who haven't made up their mind yet between Lovely and Malik, and folks who may not feel like it's important to get out and vote in the primary. So Malik, I'm wondering what you would say to those. What would you say to folks who aren't sure? And what would you say to folks that might not bother to get out and vote?
Thank you, Jane.
Well,
go ahead, Malik.
Thanks, Jane. I say to people who might not be sure and folks who may not get out to vote is that you have the opportunity, once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, to decide what it is that which you want your city to be. I think that we're at a time right now in our community where we need someone that can build trust and transparency back and build bridges to so many in the community that just don't trust government. And one thing about me, as I'll say, is you may not agree with me at the end of the day, but you will always know that you've been heard. And if you listen and if you look at what's going on around the country, why people have been reacting the way they have is because they feel as though their government has not listened to them. And I know what it's like not to be feel as though you're not being heard. Right. I started out as a youth leader. I've been to many protests over the years to try to bring change. And I think that now if you want to have a leader that really is going to be able to bring the broad cross section of folks together to be able to listen to them, I think that that is necessary. And I hope that that will appeal to some people. I've had people stand up and I've been doing and I'm exhausted because I've done hundreds of events now since January. And what some people will say, you may not always agree with Malik, but I will tell you this, that whenever I had an interaction with him, I know that I was heard and I know that what I talked about was included in the final product. And that's important. And I think we need that right now in our city. And that's what I'm committed to.
Last couple of minutes here. What do you think we've learned most about the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative since it launched? What did we learn about it and our city and poverty?
Man, that's a good question. I'll tell you what we learned. We learned that it's hard. It's hard. And you can't solve poverty overnight. That's what I think we've learned. We've learned that. But I think that we also learned that you have to take a multi-pronged approach to poverty, as we have to do with all issues, that there are no easy answers. I always tell people, and some people say, I'm known for being pretty blunt. That's not going to change. And I always tell people, if you just tell me it's just one thing that we need to do, you don't know what you're talking about. So it's not just one thing. So I always say jobs. Yes, jobs are important. But if you don't couple jobs with training, it won't work. Right. Because if someone who's never had a job and you don't give them training on the soft skills, and this is what we talk about in our youth opportunity agenda when we talk about the youth to jobs program, it's it's you got to do both. So we learned that it's complex, and because it's complex, we have to attack every single facet of it. And poverty, you have to remember, so much of it is intergenerational, right? It's intergenerational. So how do you break those intergenerational challenges that you have with poverty? If the mother was poor, and then the child was poor, and then they have children, and their children are poor, how do you break that? Where's the cycle? Will you start to break that with education, with jobs, with skills? Those things are important. I think we've learned that from the poverty initiative in our community, that guess what? It's hard, it's not easy, and it's not something that can be solved overnight.
Malik Evans is running for mayor of Rochester. Where do you want people to learn more about the work that you're doing, Malik?
Please learn more at malikevans.org. It has the bio, it has detailed plans. There's even a spot for you to tell me what you think about the plans. We've been trying to be extremely detailed in what it is that we're saying we're going to do. And we look forward to continuing the conversation over this next month.
I don't know if the mayor will agree to join us, but I hope that perhaps she will and change her mind. And if she does, we'll give her own space, or perhaps we can get you both back here together. I would appreciate that. We'll keep trying that. But in the meantime, I want to thank you for taking the time to come on with us, Councilman Evans. Thanks for making time, and I look forward to the next conversation.
Thank you, Evan. Thanks for having me, and have a great day.
Malik Evans, candidate for mayor of Rochester. Mayor Lovely Warren has been invited. I didn't hear back from City Hall, and she told our partners at City News that her interview with them was just for them. So that's where we are, and we hope that changes, but we'll keep working on that. And we've got more connections coming up in a moment.